dear listener, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast that's only really a profile piece. You know, hair and clothes and nonsense. I'm Nathan.
I'm James.
I'm Todd.
And, I'm a Terrahawk Zeroid chock full of Diamante kiddie fans for this one.
Well, it's our third annual end of the world, and who could possibly have imagined that it would be at the hands of the Prime Minister of Great Britain?
Yeah, who'd have guessed?
So we're planning to run and skulk and lurk for a bit until we can find somewhere warm and dry to sit down and discuss the sound of drums. So Harold Saxon is the master, and he has just been elected Prime Minister of Great Britain.
And he has a wife.
How do we feel about that?
Beard.
Well, Stephen Moffat actually does make that joke, doesn't he, in Time Crash a little bit later on, the master's rubbish beard, and he's clearly referring to Lucy Saxon there. I think that this is something pretty amazing, and I do think that this episode was broadcast, you know, just a matter of days before Tony Blair resigns, and you have to think that John Sim is another Tony Blair.
Very much so.
Yeah, so he's young.
But with far more charm and I would say ability.
Well, he's sort of young and charming. Everyone voted for him for some reason, but no one can remember why. He's kind of a middle way, isn't he? Like, he's a third way. He's not Labour or Tory. He's in the middle somewhere.
But with even more war crimes.
And that's the thing, you know. So at the end of the episode, billions of bombs descend from the sky, wiping people out. And next week, we're going to see him kind of turning all of Europe into, you know, like a giant missile launching pad. So this is Russell at his angriest, I think, at Blair, even angrier than when he killed him and stuffed him in a cupboard in Aliens of London 2 years ago.
That's very true.
Oh, I've forgotten about that.
Yeah. So this is, you know, much more political, I think, than we're generally inclined to think of it.
We've already been through the Congress of the Willing, and we were congressional in that part.
We were.
Being Australians, yeah. So, you know, the full fat lie that was being discussed. I would like to think that had something to do with the destruction of Harold Saxon's reign in whatever this year was, 2007. Mm. But we'd already got to the point that no, war crimes and indeed war hardware just makes you look purposeful.
Yes. Yeah, that's right.
They get things done, this lot, don't they? Well, this might have actually been the turning point in our Western history where we actually did quite like the idea of a Charlemagne, but with more knifey things and elephants.
I was actually hunting on Google, like trying to find whether anyone else had decided that Harold Saxon was Tony Blair. And I did find an article that referenced Sound of Drums, a fairly recent article, and said that it was very notable and memorable as a depiction of Tony Blair that for once wasn't being done by Michael Sheen.
Actually, they've got the same waxy, polished, putrescent quality, haven't they? Something that's really so fecundly ripe that you don't want to poke it too much because you know it'll exude.
It is wonderful seeing him.
And that's just his performance.
Yes. It's wonderful seeing him. So we see him on the screen very soon after they arrive. So they arrive on Earth in the present day. We don't see them escaping from last week's cliffhanger. And very soon they see him on television. And I think we discover, or have discovered, that it is only 4 days since Leo's birthday party. So Tish has, we were speculating about this earlier on in the season, but Tish has literally had the most impressive week career-wise.
Yes, we've been talking about this, her job resume and the jobs that she goes through and how and what she's doing in her week.
Yeah, no, it's one hell of a week. I mean, Harold Saxon's clearly been engineering it because we discover that Harold Saxon was behind the Lazarus experiment. Professor Lazarus mentions him in the episode and we get another reference to it this week.
There are so many nasty, well, should we say nasty? Let's just say visceral RTD nods to what millennials' expectations are as well. You know he's looking at all of us, well, slightly younger than us, saying, this is what you think a career path is going to be for you, yeah, don't you? Yeah. Just you wait.
There's even that line, how did you think that you got the job so quickly just on your talent? Or something like
that. Yeah. And she blankly looks at him, yeah, well, I'm pretty.
What do we think of John Sim? Let's go straight in. We saw him very briefly last week. How do we feel about him as the master in this episode?
I think he's my least favourite master of all time.
Ooh,
edgy.
Less than Anthony Ainley. Yes. Less than, what's his face from the beginning of the TV movie? Gordon Tippett.
Oh, yeah, he was stunning.
The other one from the Pet Shop Boys with always wears a hat.
No.
His house in London is all glass floors. You don't want to go there if you've, you know, had a few.
James, why is he your least favourite?
Yeah, why is he your least favourite?
I don't know. It's just I liked him at the time, but he's been surpassed by Michelle Gomez.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think when he's brought back, we're getting ahead of ourselves, he's much more masterly.
I think it's one of those things where whenever anybody comes into a role, they do it a certain way. And if you look at Tennant or Matt Smith or whatever, the first couple of episodes that they do, there's certain things that then they rein back and they change, right? And I think here he's got to make an impact immediately. I mean, he's following on from last week with Derek Jacobi being the master. So he's got to, you know, he's putting his stamp on what it is, and the script is written in a certain way to make a contrast between what was last week and what was this week. I absolutely and utterly loathed him back in 2007. I hated him beyond all belief.
I can tell where this is going.
I hated him.
Why did you really
dislike him? Because he was just so over the top, and I just, and the one scene which I still don't like is when he starts pulling all those funny faces in the cabinet and he's about to kill off the
rest of the cabinet.
And he's doing his thumbs up stuff and pulling all those funny faces, and I still don't like that sequence. I think it's too far. We've had all these things saying he's been around for 18 months but we don't see it. It's all just said. So the first thing you see is this big over the top, I'm, you know, destroying all these people, but we don't see the restraint that he's had in the last 18 months.
I mean, to be fair, I don't think we can see that.
Oh, but, no. Yeah. That's one of the things to do with the plotting of the script and where Russell is taking us with the conclusion of this season, that you can't get around that because of the decisions that are made in terms of the story sequencing.
Yeah.
But that one sequence in the whole episode, it just set me off back in 2007, 2008. And from that point in time, I just could not see anything but over the top.
Yeah.
See, for me, that nailed that he was poltering our Tennant. Like, I thought he was really doing Tennant in that scene.
Yeah. Okay. And that's what he has to do. He has to be Tennant.
He's always the shadow of the Doctor. So.
But to go back to what you were saying is that we've now obviously seen more stories with him. And so when I came back to watch this, I edited that out of my head, that sequence. And I said, I want to see what you're doing in all the other sequences, which I've sort of blotted out. And I just think that he's absolutely and utterly stunning.
Yeah, I think he's perfect.
There is subtlety. There are moments of stillness, like on the tarmac, and other one-liners which are just fed in. And it is – I've totally changed my mind. Totally. Listeners, believe it or not. and I absolutely adore him in this episode.
I think that they haven't got the master right since Delgado, and the reason is, and we said this at the time, you know, Delgado is just Pertwee only foreign, and Sim needs to be Tennant. You know, he needs to be a mirror of the Doctor, and particularly for new fans, he can't just be some guy with a BBC press on beard, which is what Ainley was. He has to be the Doctor. And so they choose someone who is the star of the other big science fiction television program at the time.
Life on Mars.
Yeah. And so the threat is in this two-parter, and it sort of happens that the Master takes over from the Doctor as the most fun and interesting thing to watch. And our reaction, our initial reaction to John Sim is a little bit like an old school fan's initial reaction, say, to Tennant or Smith. You know, the reaction that the War Doctor has in Day of the Doctor about how these kids are running around pretending to be the Doctor with their timey-wimey and their giant sonic screwdrivers.
Am I having a midlife crisis?
Yeah, yeah. So he needs to be like Tennant. And so I agree with you. That scene, I quite like the, you know, the tapping on the table and the gas mask stuff and all of that. But when he does the, when I'm being serious, I'm like this, and when I'm not being serious, I'm like that, I was more on board with that this time. But I didn't much like that at the time. I thought that that was a little bit misjudged. But it's just of a piece with this fantastic, fantastic performance.
When Vivian Rook is killed by the Toclophane and he opens and closes that door, I absolutely adore that.
That's wonderful.
See, I just, I hate that.
No.
It's so, so good. Disrespectful. Like, yes. I know that's the way you're supposed to feel. It's supposed to say, you know, this man is evil. Look at how he's treating this woman's,
dead.
Know, like, horrible murder.
What would Tony and Cherie have done?
Yeah, precisely that. They would have done exactly that.
but I just, like, in that sort of 4 or 5 minutes that she's in the episode, I really warm to that character,
yeah,
which is what you're supposed to do, I know. And then she's horribly murdered. And I just, it really upsets
me. That's Russell. That's a deliberate choice by Russell. That's not John Sims' performance. And the fact that he's sort of biting his finger or, you know, pulling a funny face as he opens the door 2 or 3 times to have her still screaming, that's really funny. He knows he's on television and he's treating the death like a sort of comedy cartoon death.
Yeah.
But I love the moments just before that when she's talking to Lucy,
yeah,
and then it pulls back and he's standing there quietly and subtly. It's just a brilliant moment. And Lucy is completely unhinged, but she appears to be completely in control, but she's obviously
Lucy,
not.
Lucy isn't just the British television audience. Lucy isn't just Susan for this episode. She's actually the voting public that voted Harold Saxon in. It's funny how those two. But do you agree? Because Todd, that for me is the moment that this episode actually crunches and goes cold metal in my heart. When there is the appeal to Lucy's. It's not very kind to the Tories, is it? Even though we know that he's not necessarily a Tory. But there's that moment of, I've accepted my privilege, I've signed forms, and now I'm ready to do what must be done to the Panama and Suez. Oh, I'm sorry, no, I'm not the Queen. That what must be done to establish my power.
She's a horrible, horrible posh girl.
I actually think I tend to disagree. I think she's just a person who's realised that a mammal, like the rest of us, who's realised our comfort and security comes before. Can I just put in that Friday I went to the march with, I think, 3 million other people or 4 million other people for the climate change a year after that little 16-year-old girl. Thank you, Greta. That's the difference. But for the rest of us and for people even on the feed on the Holy Book of Faith were saying, you know, relatives of mine were saying, well, the rest of us were at work so the children would have a job.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I actually got that. I thought, oh.
Great.
Yeah, but no, I get it. They're terrified.
Yeah.
So and terror demands comfort.
And we will see more of that next week because we do find what it is, what has happened to Lucy that has turned her into this kind of weird shell of a person who is all just sort of posh girl performance but has nothing left inside her at all. And
much like this podcast.
Yeah.
I thought she was actually, at the time, I thought she looked a bit like Kylie Minogue from various video
That's
clips.
Harsh.
Given another couple of weeks.
Like Please Stay video. And then, of course, Kylie does turn up in a couple of weeks and looks absolutely nothing like her with terrible hair.
Well, Kylie's my age. So.
But I think, is it Alexandra's performance as Lucy is just sublime. She just supports John Sims so well and it's just lovely having that contrast. And yeah, he has just shone and just shot up, in my opinion, in this episode.
Do you know the one moment of performance that just made my blood run cold is where he's looking at the camera and the camera is absolutely conspiring with him and he goes, "Peoples of the earth, please attend carefully." Oh. And he knows it's a quote from Legopolis. He's doing it to camera. The camera moves in on him as he says it. He's so excited by it. And you know, he's displacing the Doctor. He offers Lucy a jelly baby as well. And there's no way that that isn't just, "I'm going to be the Doctor. And not only that, I'm going to be the most compelling and charismatic Doctor, you know, in the history of the show." And that's the threat that the Master poses. And what this does is it has him having an incredibly successful plan. And we have never seen that before. Think about season 8, where every month he was being foiled by the Doctor.
I totally and utterly agree with you. This is the first time ever that he actually gets his plan to succeed.
Yeah.
It never has succeeded. Ainley was just like, you know, thrown away with rubbish plots. And poor Roger Delgado, you just knew that it was, you know, we get to a point where it's all just going to go belly up.
Yeah.
And this is the first time where he's succeeding at every single point along the way, you know, when he talks about the medical student and the bomb is already there.
He's
manipulated.
Jeffrey Beavers wasn't unsuccessful, was he?
No, but the scale of what he was doing, I mean, he's mostly powerless. Yeah. Whereas here, just the massive scale of it, that he's doing it in front of the entire world, and we get to see what the Master would do if he won. And
it's not that different from right now.
Well, so Stephen Moffat had this thing about Missy where he had to have her kill people fairly frequently because otherwise we would like her too much, you know. We still – it didn't work. We still loved her enormously.
Especially when she could kill Chris Addison.
Yeah, yeah. But having him just kill the cabinet and, you know, at the end of the episode, he kills 600 million people, you know, like – it's super, super bleak and horrible, and he's just incredibly great. This is the best we've ever seen the Master. It might not be the best performance, like maybe Delgado is better sometimes, but I just think this is an extraordinary story for the Master.
But in the same moment, he also fulfills Doctor Who's educational remit by
explaining what decimate means.
Yes, he does. Thank you. Tom moment, wasn't it?
I love the fact that subtly in the plot, you know, we talk about the Doctor says as if he's mesmerised the world.
Yeah.
And we're using current technology with the whole Archangel network so that he's still the Master was always sort of hypnotic. Like there's all these subtle threads back to how he was with Roger Delgado that we as classic series fans are going to pick up on. And the first time through, I think I was just so sort of like – stunned at the overchop performance and that a lot of things, these subtleties that Russell has been threading through things over various episodes, I just didn't pick up on, which is why I love this episode even more than I like. This has improved so much for me. This is, besides Blink, this is my favorite episode of the season.
Yeah.
The reason the Master works now for the reboot of the series is the reason the series is working. We've come to, correct me if you, you know, disagree, come to see the whole of Doctor Who, which I call real Doctor Who, as in 63-2. It never entered. Is because it belonged in its own alternate time, if you like. And it belonged to the BBC world of Penelope Keith was just up the road and Tom and Barbara were just next door. It was a lovely universe where things, even when they went horribly wrong, would always be corrected. And everyone who was in charge was essentially okay. And there were a few awful characters. There were a few, but there was always a lovely Sir Charles if there was going to be a war machine. You always had someone reliable. Even whatever side of politics, everyone was pretty much decent. But there was still contemporaneity, and certainly by the late 70s and into the 80s, and even before J&T, we had that sense of things are starting to actually change and unravel. And we've mentioned Green Death, and we've mentioned the Peladon EU-EC crisis and such like. But we're now at a point where things have moved so far in reality, in this truth, politics, in the environment, just the fact that we now I would say there was a really good piece in The Guardian last week on the end of Western democracy and what we now accept as gross fallacies, gross mistruths, and utter, in fact, denial of the humanity of many of the peoples that we once, you know, either in the colony or the way that we produce arms and that's how we make our money, or hi, Harold Saxon. We are now so complicit in this, we are actually Lucy Saxon. We are completely Lucy Saxon. It is our responsibility that this has all happened. And this is – because I love Russell because even when he talks about his childhood, he goes – to the very, very darkest place. I don't think you can ever underestimate how dark Russell's thinking actually is. Years and Years proves it for all of us. Mm-hmm. Years and Years is actually just this show.
Yeah.
These three episodes just put slightly outside the Valiant and down onto Earth. It's the same thing. So, yeah, Russell is really pointing the blame at us, and that's why it's uncomfortable and really entrancing to watch.
So, I mean, the original Master is sort of part of the establishment, and although he sort of kills people occasionally,
like the Empire did,
he is,
it was for a just cause,
he's still not quite a monster. It's not until Hinchcliffe brings him back as, you know, yet another sort of long dead kind of threat from the distant past that he actually tries to sort of destroy the whole planet.
I think Hinchcliffe was doing that just as a naughty stabbed Terence Dix and Barry Letts to say, this is what your show is like.
Hinchcliffe? Or do you think it's Robert Holmes?
Well, I think it's both. But before that, the Master was always sort of rather tame, and he was part of the ensemble in season 8. And if you look at all the press photos and stuff like that, it's like he's a regular character. And he does risk rather being kind of a bit neutered. And, you know, we see him working alongside UNIT a couple of times. And it is, I think, indicative of the kind of trust of the establishment that we had back in the 70s. And now that's all unmoored. And now that we've had, you know, very recently a British Prime Minister openly telling lies about Iraq's capabilities and encouraging sort of a massive war that killed hundreds of thousands of people. So when the Master comes back, and he comes back as the establishment, he's a monster. And however sort of his public persona is and however entertaining he is, Russell makes sure that he kills just huge numbers of people. And it will only escalate next week. The sort of things that he's described as having done next week are appalling. And all the time he's dancing about in his kind of giant palace up in the sky, completely invulnerable, you know, lying to and manipulating the public that voted for him. I think this is a better conception of the Master because it doesn't have that trust to the establishment that informs the previous Master. I think the previous Master is too cozy and too domestic.
But he's still quite happy to send the torture team off to the Himalayas and not actually just kill them off.
Well, yeah. And that, again, is a sort of comedy cartoon thing, isn't it? It's like, well, why aren't Torchwood here? Well, because it's not that show.
And it's a plot necessity.
Yeah. And so he does it in a sort of comedy way.
And we can't kill them off because,
well, they've got to do that next season.
They've got to do that themselves.
Well, exactly.
So we're back in Martha's apartment.
What, very high ceilings?
She does have very high ceilings.
How do you get that thing in there? I could never. I've always wanted a police box in my bedroom.
We've got this team of Martha and Jack and the Doctor, which was introduced last week, and I think there was a great chemistry between them all last week, and it's great to see them all working together again and her bond with Jack. They're in Martha's bedroom. The Doctor is trying to work out what the Master's doing. We've got that whole sequence, which I think is a joyous sequence, where you've got Vivian interviewing Lucy and giving her all the information about Harold Saxon's not real at the same time as the Doctor is working all that out in parallel, which I always like in storytelling.
We get that next week as well, a very similar thing where two plot threads converge on the same kind of revelation.
And of course, then the whole, you know, the Master is again 20 steps ahead and has planted this bomb behind the television, which I just think is hilarious.
A magpie television, did you notice? It's electricals. I think that this stuff now is really great, and now we go into a political thriller. I think it's one of Martha's most superb moments as well, where she's got this great relationship with the doctor going, and then the moment her family's under threat, she just turns straight to him and says, you know, don't tell me what to do.
That is a fantastic moment, Nathan.
She's so good then. And the doctor knows better than to tell her what to do, and so he just goes along with her. But suddenly we're being chased by the government, and there are bombs exploding and people firing machine guns and stuff.
So most of those car chase scenes are actually Freema driving instead of her stunt double, with the visual effects supervisor sandwiched between David and John Barrowman
in the back seat.
Because her driving was far more terrifying than any stunt a ranger could have done themselves.
Setting off all the little explosions.
I think that this sort of thread of the plot really works. I just think it's not something Doctor Who gets to do all that often.
That's wonderful.
It's terrific.
The closest we've had is Mike Yates backing up into a trench in Planet of the Spiders.
But I'd love the people coming for Francine and Clive and sort of, and you know, herding them into the back of a truck and stuff. And her trying to manipulate, like, it's, you know, that thing, there's a meme, you know, like you're being held hostage by someone, what would you tweet that would make it clear to everyone that you were being held hostage without kind of giving the game away? And, you know, like I would tweet, I'm now about to sit down and watch my favourite Doctor Who episode of the 1960s, you know, The Massacre. And what Francine's...
So I would just feel you've come round.
What Francine's tweet is, Clive and I are getting back together.
Your father might give it another go.
Yeah.
Have you noticed their whole run feels like an episode of This Is Your Life? And it's the way Saxon introduces them, the family, but the whole thing. But then it ends with the chitty chitty bang bang child catcher throwing them into the back of the van. And they're pulling exactly the same faces.
And it backs up your theory about this episode, because what they're saying is they're being bundled into the van to their neighbours who are watching it happen. They're saying, you voted for Harold Saxon. Yeah. This is what you were voting for.
Yeah.
When I originally watched this, I just thought, you bitch, about Martha's mum, because I hated her so much. But now, of course, coming into it, I see how manipulated that she's been and how unconvinced she is. But has she made the right decision? She's still second-guessing herself. And, I mean, I think it's great that Clive is the one that tells Martha to just run. Like, he's not a great husband, but he's a wonderful father. And then Francine's, I helped you, whatever she had to say. And at the same time, Martha is just telling the doctor off, you know, it's all your fault and all that sort of stuff. It's just magnificent and really well acted by Francine.
Yeah. No, she's really something.
But Francine wanted security. She voted for the safety of her family.
Well, I think she didn't vote for Saxon, though, because...
Oh, no, she does. No,
she says, I voted for you.
Typical British voting public.
when she confronts the sinister woman or the mysterious woman... Is she sinister or mysterious?
Eloise Dutoit.
Yeah.
Sinister woman.
And she says, I'm not going to tell you who I voted for. And she's certainly playing it like she's saying that she didn't vote for Saxon. When she's sort of packing up at the end of 42, she is quite hostile, I think, and perhaps because she is being manipulated. She realises she's being manipulated into ratting on her daughter.
Yes, it's the first time that that I begin to feel a bit of sympathy for her because she's dawning on her what she's done. Like, she had that series of unfortunate events to be manipulated into this situation, and she's now going, have I done the right thing? I probably haven't. And again, this is reinforced here when she screams out, I was helping you.
And she's terrified. Her and Clive are both terrified in the kitchen with those people around, I think.
As she should be. I don't know that any of us in the same situation with children would behave any differently.
Yeah. Well, certainly one of her biggest characteristics is how protective she is of her daughter. And that continues, you know, all the way to sort of Stolen Earth when we next see her. She absolutely has Martha's safety as her first priority.
The whole family is obviously Tish is arrested, and then Martha phones Leo. Of course, he's not available because he's off doing whatever
Top of the Pops or something like
whatever that. Whatever he's doing. So then it means that the storyline has to be written so that he's off in Brighton, but he manages to get into hiding. But, of course, that leads – the Master is listening into that telephone conversation, which then leads into that wonderful exchange between the Doctor and the Master.
I think that, too, it's better than the big one that we get next week. It's the only time – like, they don't actually sort of properly meet until the end of the episode – and it's the one where they get to catch up. We actually see what's been happening with both of them since the last great Time War.
Yeah, I mean, there's a bit of an info dump, like the Time Lords resurrected me, you know. But it's good to have that moment because we only see the Dobby Doctor or the Doctor in really old makeup.
Yeah.
So it's nice to have Tennant and Sim go have a one-on-one at this point in the story.
Yeah. It is interesting too, isn't it? Because what fascinates the Master is that the Doctor's killed everyone.
But he also starts talking about the constant drumming in his head, which, again, is a very subtle thing with Russell that's going to come into play, obviously, a bit further down the track. And at the time, you just think it's related to, like, the story title or whatever. You don't really see the bigger picture. I think there's so much going on in that phone call, especially when he starts saying, like, does he say it or is it on the news that they tick every...
No, he says they tick every demographic box and he calls them the girly and the freak, but I'm not going to say which one is weird.
We're right here.
That's right. Much like this podcast.
No denial on this corner. No.
I think we get some really great stuff with the Doctor, Jack and Martha when they're on the run.
I'd like to hear more of that. Yeah.
I love
those
scenes.
The Scooby crew. Yeah.
You know, they're eating chips. Jack's revealing that he works for Torchwood. The doctor describes standing in the great schism or whatever with that gormless child that plays the Master. Who just
actually played young David Tennant in Casanova.
He did.
Oh, I think he's
charming.
And was in Torchwood as well.
Yeah, he's some – yes, obviously the kid of someone involved. But I do like that the Scooby gang are constantly referencing Rose Tyler's mouth. It's either chips going in or what did you say about the Great Cavern?
Thank you, Richard. But also, you know, the whole Archangel network and the rhythm is everywhere. All this stuff that's been alluded to is just getting explained. And then we get the three TARDIS key concept, which I really quite like. And that leads to the bit of bonding between Martha and Jack over... It's like you fancy someone and they don't even know you exist. And Jack says, you too. Huh?
Oh, see, I love that. I think that's great. And that kind of takes the sting a little bit out of that stupid subplot that we've been contending with all year. Can we unpack some things there? So we get a backstory with the Master where at the age of 8, and we have, you know, it's now canonical that Time Lords have childhoods, you know, and stuff like that. Russell kind of humanises them a bit.
Lala did that for us.
Yes, we had time tots, didn't we?
They're not woven from a loom.
No, they're not woven from a loom.
They might still be, but no, they still had time nannies
and
time attics where they would sit up there and read Time Beatrix Potter.
That's exactly it. But the untempered schism, they all look into the untempered schism and it drives the Master mad. And what the Master gets as a result of that is he has the Doctor Who theme going on in his head.
Great
from
parenting
then on.
There, oh lords.
Yeah. But I think that's intentional. I think we're meant to feel that's terrible.
Though Russell has claimed that that has nothing to do with the Doctor Who theme. It was actually the sound of his alarm clock.
Yes, well, but he doesn't get the final say on this.
No, he doesn't.
Everyone else kind of reads it as the Doctor Who theme, and I think there's some...
It can drive a child of mad.
Yes.
Right here.
See, I don't really like that. Like, you know, is the Master mad from that point on, or does it take a number of years to manifest?
Well... I think that it is the thing where he reinvents in some way each of the elements of the old show that he brings back. And I don't think, and I think L. Sandifer says this at some point as well, I don't think that you can see Roger Delgado larking about on the set of The Claws of Axos and imagine that he's got drumming going on in his head all the time.
Not unless they slipped him a tab or two.
Yeah,
but I, you know, I think Katie might have been up for it.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
Have a mushroom. Have two.
But
it's Welsh. It's good for you.
But what drives the Master then is time. The destruction that the master wreaks is the same destruction that time eventually wreaks, that he has been affected by the time vortex and he goes around dedicating himself to destruction. And we saw last episode what destroyed all those conglomerations on the planet Malcacero. It was just time, just time. So the destruction that the master is committed to is
Kylie Minogue's hair.
Yes. Well, that was time too. So it is all about time. And I think that that just makes the master a little bit more epic, a little bit less of a cartoon villain who, you know, does things just to annoy the doctor or to entertain the audience. He's there. It's a peculiarly Time Lord way of being villainous.
Look, I get your point. And they've got to make the master a threat equal to and greater than the previous two major villains, the Daleks and the Cybermen. So he's got to be up there and he's got to be totally unhinged and capable of what he eventually does do, taking over the world, which I guess the others never quite did succeed.
No. Like I said, I don't think you can watch Delgado and think that that's what's going on in his head, but we're bringing the master back for a new audience and we have to give him something just a little bit more than he's the Doctor's Moriarty for no particular reason, which was our previous backstory.
And look, the audience seemed to like it because the ratings go up between this episode and the next substantially.
I think it's an amazing, an amazing spectacle. And I think giving the Doctor two companions to confront it, having, you know, other people who we care about, having this all kind of built up to in this amazing way, it does feel like an old-fashioned multi-part story just because it's been going on for so long. It works really well, I think. This is by now, even now, a familiar villain and a familiar environment, and I think it just works terrifically well.
We've had the build-up. We had last week, and then this is building, like it's really, it really is stepping it up to another level. And obviously we get up to the Valiant. The president-elect is killed by the Toclafane. Again, another moment I don't particularly like, which is where John Sim is, what's he doing? I've got something here. Oh, when he zips and unzips his mouth. I hate that.
I kind of like that.
Ironically. Well, because he doesn't give a crap about the last president of the United States. And that's an incredible scene. That is the same scene that we were talking about before, the scene on the tarmac. And by now, the Doctor, Jack and Martha have been so successfully defeated by the master that they have to resort to not being seen. So they've got this perception filter thing. And I think perception filter is a brilliant name for the technology because it is a real thing that we have in our head. Yeah. And so they're outside of society. They can't interact with anyone. They've been successfully expelled from the world. And they're there watching him and he's being annoying. He's being a childish, you know, dick to the president because he doesn't care. He's not cowed by him.
It is a mask because I think he knows that they're there. When he's standing there on that tarmac, he senses and he knows what's going on.
And that wonderful thing where the wind blows open his jacket and it's all lined in red, like Pertwee's cape or something.
That's a great shot and a great moment and one of his best moments.
Mm. Yeah. And it is. It's the mask. It's the same mask that Tennant has, that comedy, silly performance. See, I love it when he welcomes the Joneses out of the van and he's rubbing his hands and dancing from foot to foot and spreading his arms out and laughing and stuff.
See, I like all of that.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
I'm very inconsistent about what I like and don't like, but there's certain things where I just think, can you just rein it back just a little?
I don't want him to rein it back. I want it to be as huge as possible, I think.
Yeah. So the president-elect line was Russell misunderstanding what the term president-elect means.
Yeah.
He is the president. President-elect in the Waiting American to be, sense means the president, like Donald Trump before he took power with president.
Lady-in-waiting, we would say.
This president is the president. It's just that he's misused the term.
Yeah. He thinks it just means elected president.
Yeah. Oh.
He's wonderful. He's got a very George Bush kind of feel to him. He's clearly very dim. Do you remember him in Broken News? He was like the kind of dumb American newsreader in the sort of American cable channel.
IBS News.
Yeah, IBS News.
Irritable Bowel Syndrome News. with Claudia Christian.
Yeah, it's wonderful. If you can find it, there's only sort of six
it's
episodes.
Complex.
Sounds great.
It's really, really good. And, you know, that line about welcoming the master to the planet Earth and its associated moon, which I just think is absolutely brilliant. And, you know, if God wants you to have mastery over me, he is kind of a sort of dim-witted George Bush character.
I'm rolling my eyes, but yes, it is. You're totally right, Nathan.
And it is part of that great tradition of killing off. As we've observed each time, we kill off the Prime Minister of Great Britain in every single one of RTD's Doctor Who series. We do actually properly kill off the Prime Minister next week, but for one brief glorious moment, we thought we'd escalated to the President of the United States for Series 3. Yeah, so we have already decided that aging makeup is this season's BBC foam machine. It's going to occur over and over again. This is the second time we've seen Tennant in aging makeup this season. I've been watching these on the upscale Blu-ray versions, which are not kind to the aging makeup.
So the aging makeup for Tennant in this story was actually based on William Hartnell?
I've read that. Is that true, though?
But aged up, because William Hartnell is not that old. But no. they specifically went, Billy, let's try and make him look like Bill Hartnell.
I think, too, giving the Master a thing that's very Time Lordy, you know, that's about time, that's about suppressing regenerations. Like, think of how Time Lordy this Master is. We've seen him regenerate. We've seen him steal a TARDIS. You know, he does Time Lordy things, and now his next job, the one thing that we know that Time Lords do, is be the star of the BBC television program Doctor Who. And so that's the next thing that the Master's going to manage to do, and he does it by rendering the Doctor unable to do that job anymore, unable to run up and down corridors, unable to, you know, be funny and witty. And he gets to take over and be the most fun and entertaining thing in the room. I think it's great. I think that this is the moment where he takes over as star of the show. And, you know, like our original DVD box sets have a picture of John Sim on one of them as if he has even taken over.
He's on the back cover.
Yeah, he's on the back cover as if he's taken over the show.
Well, yes, I mean, he from this point on to the cliffhanger, we've got him showing Martha, bringing in her family. He's in control there. He says, if I told you the truth, your hearts would break to the Doctor. We've got a bit of an allusion to, there's a mystery here with the Toclophane. Suddenly we've got Here Come the Drums, Voodoo Child by the Rogue Traders, and they're dancing around.
Lucy's dancing around. Is fantastic. She's so out of it.
Sort of foot shuffling.
Yeah.
Like she's off her face on Valium.
Yeah.
Valiant. Those fumes are pretty intoxicating, aren't they?
I have to have my little fanboy moment and say I'm just finally glad that Captain Jack has a role in this universe as Captain Scarlet. And I know I've said it before, but it really is Captain Scarlet.
Yeah.
Twee, twee.
It's wonderful.
Same wooden acting too. Go on.
Our heroes are so much on the back foot. You know, Martha exits stage right, but there's that glimmer of hope that when she says, "I'm coming back," and I just think it's deliciously delivered by Freema.
Yeah,
she is.
How do you feel about Freema in this one?
She is the help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. Like she is the Doctor's only hope. Like she is the only. Yeah. How do I feel? I think this is. This episode might be Martha's most shining moment in the entire season.
In the entire season. Oh, interesting.
I think she is just that phenomenal in this episode. I have more to say about performance next week.
That'll be interesting, yeah.
I think we have to remember that, you know how people were quite harsh on her at the time? This was basically her first acting role. So, like, I think you can actually see her acting growing in this season. You actually get to a point towards the end of the series where she kind of finds her feet, and I think it's in this episode.
I think she's quite amazing in this, but I'm prepared to go on the record before next week's episode to say that I think she's amazing next week as well.
I'm not saying she's not, but I don't like the performance next week compared to this.
What we haven't talked about much is Autoclophane, and they're not real as far as the Doctor knows. And I do think it's telling that there are 6 billion of them. And that's the first hint that they're us, because there's the same number of Autoclophane as there are of us in 2007. I think we're probably more than that in 2007, but that's the number that we had in our heads. And so it's already a hint that they're us. And then the Master says that the identity of the Autoclophane will break the Doctor's heart. And so that's a kind of another indication. But they are, of course, the monsters that were devised for Dalek, for absence of the Daleks.
Yes. They are the absence.
Yeah, yeah. So when in Series 1 Rob Sherman was writing the Dalek episode, we weren't sure we were going to have the rights to the Daleks.
Yes, they were trying to negotiate with Terry Nation's estate.
And with Roger.
Very late in the day. Like, they were unsure that they would get them. But did you know they also were planned at one point to be used in the Satan pit.
Right, right.
Autoclophane. I'm glad that didn't happen.
I do think that we'll find out next week that they're a great idea, that there is something about them. All of, you know, the best.
Gerry Anderson's finest villains.
But, I mean, all of the best Doctor Who villains are people that have gone wrong under some kind of moral pressure.
Does that make Francine Zelda?
But back to what you're saying, the writing in this episode, all the little setups, like from the Archangel Network to what you were just saying there, to the TARDIS beam, the Paradox Machine, there's all these little subtle things that Russell is doing that you don't actually see where it's going, and it's really very clever writing.
Yeah, and it comes together next week in a way. Like, people always say, you know, Russell doesn't set things up properly. We needed another Leaden exposition scene in order to sell this development at the end of the episode. But this one is absolutely, no one can say that. And Russell writes about that in The Writer's Tale. He doesn't want to stop for a dumb exposition scene. He knows that as viewers, we've watched TV before, we don't need that. And it's not what Russell's interested in, but here I think it's incredibly well set up. Everything comes together amazingly well.
And as you've said, like, the Master is now the star of the show. He gets the voiceover at the end of the episode, even though the close-up goes onto the Doctor's face, which looks like nothing like William Hartnell, can I just say, at all.
Well, I did just watch The Three Doctors on the Blu-ray edition. So, we've been talking about parallels to the old series, but I think you've both just hit on a really interesting point, that this is antithetical to the 70s. And perhaps we look at the reason that Pertwee's era was so maligned, and it probably is the ever-presence of Basil Exposition. Mm. It's not Pertwee, and it's certainly not Delgado, but they do a lot of action figure standing around telling you what the scene's all about. And that may actually just come down to the way that drama was written then. I mean, there's a lot of people standing around, whether it be the bridge of a ship or, you know, a hamlet or quarry, they're all standing around, and they see what happens there, and then I'll tell you what happens next.
I mean, we get a fair amount of that here. We have the conversation on the phone.
Yeah, we do.
We have them sitting around talking about the Master's backstory. But quickly, we get that. We do.
And they're doing things while they're doing it.
Yeah.
Moving about.
I just feel that there's so much clever writing. There's so much serendipity here with decisions that have been made previous seasons or even this season, that everything just comes together in this episode. And, well, where do you go from here?
We're off to find a shelter somewhere and stock up on some tennis rackets and baseball bats and things. So there's every chance we'll survive until next week, when we'll be covering Last of the Time Lords. In the meantime, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts, and you can keep up with us at Flight Through Entirety on Facebook, at FTE Podcast on Twitter, and on our website, flightthroughentirety.com, where you'll find links to our other podcasts, Bondfinger and Jodie into Terror. Until next time, remember, there's no such thing as the Autoclophane. It's just a made-up word like Tory or Brexit or carbon. Thank you very much for listening, and good night.
Good night.
See you soon.
Good then.
That was Flight for Entirety, starring Todd Bilby, Nathan Bottomley, James Selwood and Richard Stone. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb, strings performance by Jane Orberg. This episode, This Is What You Were Voting For, was recorded on the 22nd of September 2019 and released on the 1st of December. If you've been finding all this backslapping and relentless appreciation rather tiresome, please tune in next week for some furious disagreement about the quality of the universally loved Series 3 finale, Last of the Time Lords.
He likes the sound of his voice.
Own drums. The sound of my own drums. Today is the 22nd of September, and we are recording The Sound of Drums. We should just do a podcast on the song. Don't you think? No.
What song?
Voodoo Child. Here come the drums, here come. Yeah, that one.
Well, who sang that?
Who sang it?
I don't know modern things.
Natalie Bassett Finger, Thing Waits Band.
Natalie Bassett Finger. I don't know her at all.
The Rouge Traders.
Oh, thank you.
I'm
the
sorry.
What? The Rogue Traders.
When they were first on American radio, yes. On me recording.
Yeah, yeah, this could be a tag. Okay. You might say something funny.
Yeah.
But the Rogue Traders, when they're first on American radio, somebody misspelt the entry on the, you know, on the digital radio sort of master file as Rouge Traders.
Lovely.
Yeah.
I have to say that you
actually
are doing
like Rouge Traders
very well there, James, with that mic technique. Okay.
It's all downhill from here.
It is.
Hurrah.
Shall I start?
Please do.
If you must.
I'm all nervous now. You're putting me off. Ooh. Okay. That was Todd's fault.
Why is it my fault? Oh, help me now, listeners.
Okay.
Oh, are we a point of thank you for reminding me. A point of, I don't know, logic. Is it listeners or listener?
It's normally dear listener.
Because there's only ever one person listening, you know, at a time. It's the way the Beeb does it. So
I don't care.
I think it's nicer to say, for me, it's nicer to say listener because it feels like you're talking to them personally.
Yes, but I don't do that. Also, I don't do that. I always do listeners.
Do you?
I do.
You don't want to change that?
No.
Tag scene.
All right, okay.
You're getting me irritated already, Richard.
That might be good, though.
I don't want to be irritated for this episode. You've got to work up to it so I can be irritated for the next episode.
I like the next episode.
Yes, but you like everything.
No, I don't. I have very good taste. And I don't like the massacre. We mentioned that.
I still think it's one of the best scripts.
Yeah, it probably is.
No, it is.
I'm relentlessly lowbrow.
The massacre.
Well,
of
middle brow.
Opinion.
No, my opinion is stolid. All right, we're all in a mood. Let's go.
Okay. Yeah, good. That's what we want. Hello, dear listener, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety.